Right, I don't think Ed needs much of an introduction. Up until recently, Ed was CTO of the OS, and now he's moved on to Google, but this is a personal view. And we're very glad to have him as our keynote speaker, so please give him a welcome.
Thanks, Steve. And yes, today, this morning, very much is a personal view. I thought I'd spend half an hour sort of talking through my experience as a grey-haired GIS professional and seeing you young upstarts coming in and disrupting my industry, thank you very much. And just some personal perspectives on that. Although I'm not here representing my employer, and anything I say this morning shouldn't be linked back to my employer, very little of what I'm going to say and argue actually go against where Google is at the moment in terms of its view of, let's just call it community or user-generated content and the activities that you guys are doing. Actually, as you'll see towards the end of what I'm talking about today, Google actually quite likes this as an approach, and it solves many of the problems that Google as a commercial organization has. So although you shouldn't have any sort of direct link between myself and what Google may or may not do in the future, it's certainly not opposed to what's going on here at the moment. Unfortunately, I can't say that for my previous employer. I tried really, really hard in my time at the Ordnance Survey to try and get the organisation to understand what was going on outside the realms of government and outside the realms of Southampton. And, you know, Ordnance Survey is an organisation full of lots of really enthusiastic, well-meaning people who are in many ways just like yourselves, who want to get on and they want to produce geographic information because they pretty much love it. They love it in the same way that you do in terms of collecting the information and finding out about the world and building solutions. But they find themselves between a rock and a hard place. And I'm not going to argue here, at least not over a coffee, maybe over a beer some point later on, about the funding of Ordnance Survey. There's enough arguments around that. I will, though, make the point that I think over the past few years, the licensing regime that the Ordnance Survey has set up, and it has done that by choice, not by edict by government, the licensing regime, i.e. how data is licensed, not whether it's licensed or not, but how it's licensed, has been controlled by the Ordnance Survey, and in doing so, it has really restricted the development of geographic information in this country. If licensing changes had been made earlier, I'm not going to argue that OpenStreetMap wouldn't need to have existed, because I think what you're doing is valuable in itself, but there would have been much more innovation. There would have been perhaps 1,000 people here discussing these ideas than the 100 or so there is at the moment. So there is a little bit of villainy there. I can't deny that. And hopefully in time things will change. Hopefully people will wake up to what you guys are doing and what the wider industry trend is in terms of the era of the professional amateur, which I'm going to cover a little bit later on. So, boost up to Ordnance Survey. The inspiration for my talk, The Cathedral and the GIS, is this book that probably many of you will have read. Show of hands, people have read this book, seen it? Yeah. It's a sort of the early thesis of open source software development, The Cathedral and the Bazaar by Eric Raymond. And it tries, in a reasonably academic approach, I think, to try and understand how and why open source software development has taken place. And a lot of the book is about the history of the development of operating systems, from Unix to Linux and the various flavors of that development. And I read this a couple of years ago, and it was quite interesting at the time, but it didn't really plug into sort of my psyche and what I was thinking about for a while. The one thing that came out of it, though, that was probably, that single phrase that sometimes catches your imagination when you're reading a book, is this one: given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow. The idea here being that, an operating system is incredibly complex and it's easy to develop, problems in an engineering sense, building an operating system. But here, rather than in a commercial company where you have a limited, finite resource of engineers, you've actually got a much wider community, and that much wider community can solve problems more rapidly than a dedicated engineering team. And often, if you've not been involved in software engineering, it's a surprise sometimes to realize how few people are involved in developing software applications. I used to work for Autodesk before my days at the Ordnance Survey, and we had an online mapping product called MapGuide. It was one of the first web GIS toolkits. And I loved it. It was a great piece of software. And used to run around trying to convince people to buy it, and they always used to buy ESRI. But I used to try. But we actually only had an engineering team of about a dozen people building this big commercial product that brought in millions of dollars of revenue. And that's often the case. It's a relatively small team. And if you've tracked the commercial GIS industry over the last couple of years, you'll realize that Autodesk have moved the development of MapGuide to an open source model, saying, well, actually, it's much better to get that wider community of developers working on this. And there are many ways as a commercial organization of generating revenue around that. Now, that approach of saying, well, for a lot of these capitally intensive activities that you might do in an information management organization, to crowdsource that and look at other ways of getting commercial revenue and opportunities is something that mapping agencies in particular need to get their head around. Because I would argue, and I will argue during the rest of this speech, that unless mapping agencies like the Ordnance Survey, and Ordnance Survey are one of the most commercially focused of all of the mapping agencies, and they understand business better than many, if they don't change their ways, most of the mapping agencies will cease to exist, or large parts of what they do will cease to exist within the next 10 or 20 years, because of what you guys are developing and what is now possible with the technology. So taking that cathedral and the bazaar as a sort of model, is it as easy to say, well, actually, the Ordnance Survey is the cathedral model, top down, we'll give a big plan and we'll send the guys out and they'll go and they'll develop something, against the distributed, more open source model, the bazaar, is that what OpenStreetMap is? In a software development sense, potentially, but I argue that probably creating geospatial data isn't exactly the same as writing software. One of the things that had to have changed and did change over the last 10 years is the availability of technology to make what you do possible and to make it less of a cathedral-driven activity, i.e. you needed big resources and direction from the center to create a geospatial database. It's relatively easy in terms of the tools that you need to develop software. You need to have an engineering mind, you need to have a computer, and let's say GCC is a compiler and you can build software. It's something you can do in your bedroom. As you all know, it's much more involved creating geospatial databases. What's changed is that technology has democratized that process. Now, I'm going to show you a video that is almost, if not more cheesy than the one that we've just seen. Now, what you need to do in this video is to listen very carefully and try and pick up the statistics. It comes from the late 1950s, and it's about Ordnance Survey. It's incredible, isn't it, just how much has changed, how different what we do is to all of that huge expression of labor, of technology, much of which we don't use or never use because it didn't work. But it was a massive organization involved in doing now what you guys do. What you saw there was largely the production process for small-scale mapping. The old, well, we know them as 50,000 scale maps. Huge difference. Now, what's really made what you guys do possible is this idea of the democratization of technology. Through, one, the GPS, yes, we all know and love, but also, the availability of these services that you know and love and potentially make use of that are a supporting mechanism there that allow you to collaborate online, to store data, to make use of services of information that are distributed around the planet. They have made it possible for a group, a community of a few thousand people in one country to replicate what was only possible to do if you were a large government institution with the backing of government and millions of pounds at your disposal. That's an incredible change. And that change is happening now across the world. And it's having a major impact on not only how geospatial data is collected, but all sorts of other information. Because that same democratization of technology is impacting on many other forms of business and commerce, because we are entering the era of the professional amateur. People now wandering around the streets who have a vague interest in a particular topic or area have at their disposal the same tools and the same capability that professionals had only a few years ago. The first area really to sort of see this happening was astronomy. Here is a nice space picture. You should always have a nice space picture in a presentation, I think. It's quite restful. What we're looking at here at the middle is a thing that looks like a sort of figure of eight. This is a supernova, sun exploding in effect. This is supernova 1987A. They never have particularly exciting names. You can probably judge when that was discovered, 1987. It was discovered by an observatory in Japan. And this is an observatory that is buried deep underground because what it observes are neutrinos, particles that are released, so the theory goes, when there is a supernova, when there's a massive galactic explosion, these strange particles reach their way to the rest of the edges of the galaxy. And to discover them, you need to be in a very quiet environment for other particles, and that's why they have these observatories buried deep underground. So at 0735 UTC, 11 neutrinos, not many, but far more than you would expect to find on a normal day, pop up to this observatory buried underground in Japan. So, the theory goes, that probably means that somewhere there's been a supernova. And the theory would suggest, because of the amount of time it takes neutrinos to travel that distance compared to the time it takes light, I'm not a great physicist, Steve's a physicist, he can explain this, you would expect in the visible spectrum to see the supernova around 3 hours later. So, the hunt starts. Everybody, search the sky, see if we can find the supernova. The only way you can do this is to have distributed resources across the world. And this was, you know, pre-internet days, but we still needed a distribution of astronomers. So, 10 o'clock universal time, so about the right sort of time you'd expect to have found the supernova. There, a guy called Ian Shelton, working in Chile, sees the supernova on his telescope. Now, this guy is a professional. He's working at an astronomy in the Andes. But to prove that it was the same supernova as the one that caused the neutrinos, we needed some evidence to suggest that there wasn't that supernova there before and it existed just afterwards. And that's where the amateurs came in. There were two amateurs in New Zealand and in Australia that at 9:30 saw nothing, so proving that this supernova hadn't occurred before the neutrinos were there, and did see, at 10:30, the supernova. So by having those amateur astronomers scanning the skies, they were able to confirm one of the major scientific discoveries of the last 20 years from astronomy, driven by amateurs. And increasingly, it is amateurs that are making discoveries in astronomy because they have at their disposal the same computer-controlled telescopes and image processing facilities that many professionals have. A few weeks ago, we all saw these photographs of the attempted bombing in Glasgow Airport. Every photograph you saw in the press was taken by a member of the general public on their camera phones or on their digital phones or whatever they had available. And these went flashing around the world. And our memories now, our understanding of this incident will have come from amateurs, people who were there with their cameras, captured the information. And this is something that the media are trying to get their heads around. And how do we manage this process? Because this isn't us. Who are these people to be out there capturing the news? But we can, we've got the capability to. Something I love that's coming up is now something that you guys probably will get into, the ability to create your own drones. Okay, if you want to get aerial photography, go and capture it yourself. Now, this is borderline illegal, which makes it even more exciting, I think. You get into a lot of trouble with the Civil Aviation Authority and the Federal Aviation Authority for doing this. But it's pretty possible now to put digital cameras, the little sort of webcammy-like cameras, strong, you know, high resolution, into a little radio-controlled aircraft with a wireless link that beams down the images that the aircraft is seeing. Amazing stuff. This guy here, Chris Anderson, who is set up this DRI Drones website, is a famous author. He's also editor of Wired magazine. Lots of people are getting into this. It's something that, if you're interested, I'm quite keen to do it. We need to get some small aeroplanes under 20 kilograms and we won't get into too much trouble, but it's going to be fun. Now this stuff is, you know, it's serious in that information and data created by the community is often the most important, the most relevant when disasters occur, when emergencies happen. We're all familiar with the you know, the disaster that was Katrina, and much of that disaster was probably of government making in terms of not being able to respond effectively to the incident in the first place. The disaster really happened in the weeks after Katrina, when there wasn't the right government response to what happened. As a result of that government response not happening, citizenry, the community, filled in the gap. So you had people using Craigslist to put in information about where there were rest centers, where there was accommodation available, where people needed immediate help. At Google, we got phone calls from the United States Coast Guard months afterwards thanking us because they were using Google Earth with the information that's being fed by Craigslist and people phoning up to locate where people were, because the information in Google Earth was more up to date than the information the Coast Guard had available to them. So here, you know, people got around the problem and they solved the issue by contributing their own information, what was relevant and needed at that particular point in time. The best people to understand that were the people involved. And the technology was there to allow them to publish, to manipulate that information, to communicate it and to spread it in a way that was important and necessary for them. It'd be interesting to think, you know, are there mechanisms, are there processes that we need to think about as a community to put some of this place, some of this information and resources in place for the time that it might be needed? Now, yesterday, pins on maps were, I think, unfairly dished by our friend Richard. I think, you know, there is a value in this. Yes, you're right, it's not cartographically elegant often, but it is a great way of people putting themselves onto the map, making the maps relevant to them because they have a particular interest or they have some information that they just want to communicate. And often a point is enough. And you can see just, you know, randomly some example pin maps there of I guess metro stations, bus stations and transport information in Manchester. The one at the bottom is, I think, car parking information in Taiwan, and then there's famous historic photographs and where they were taken. And, you know, there is loads of this stuff. Hundreds of thousands of different types of information that have been posted by the community. And, yeah, some of it might seem a bit strange, but then some entries in Wikipedia seem a bit strange. Everybody is interested in a particular topic in an area. And here, again, here's a perfect example of that democratization. The tools are available for you to put your own information on the map. And most importantly, for people to find that information. That's, again, a big change. It's now possible to discover where that information is. Now, it's interesting. Going back to Chris Anderson, the guy behind the UAVs, he's most famous for the long tail. This idea that you can have a new category of information that is commercially accessible and useful, even though the markets for that are very, very small. Because the technology to create that and to distribute it has changed radically, it's now possible to produce an economically viable book that might only be printed 10 or 15 times, and you still make money from it. Well, I've kind of hijacked the long tail principle to look at geographic information and geodata and what's available. Actually, if we see where we are today, the amount of geographic data that's available on the web at the moment is very limited. It's represented by that very thin blue line there. That's what's available now. That's what you could find if you went searching for all the geodata on the internet, both commercial and open source data. The rest of it is potentially available. At this end, there's the corporate data that sits on corporate systems behind firewalls that is not available to us. Some of that information may never be available to us for security reasons or for commercially sensitive reasons. That's fair enough. But I would argue a huge proportion of that should be available to the community for them to get access to. But most exciting is this long tail of potentially community-generated information that actually doesn't exist yet, but now we have the tools and the capability to create it. And that's what's most exciting about what you guys are doing, because you're really leading the way in doing this and showing people how that community-generated information can be created. In some cases, it's a replacement for corporate information. Sometimes it's an alternative. Sometimes it is just unique. No one else has that. We're beginning to get a much better handle on what we do have at the moment, that current GeoWeb. Here's an image that represents, let's see it particularly clearly here in the light, but represents the footprint of all of the KML and GRSS files that exist on the internet at the moment. Well, probably existed at the beginning of June. So this is every GRSS file, every KML file, and their footprint. So for some reason, the UK like stands out like a light bulb there. Not quite sure what that is, but you can see France is pretty well covered. Most of North America, most of Europe, Asia, South America, Africa, Australasia, surprisingly enough, isn't particularly well covered. It doesn't appear very well up on the slide, but you're more than welcome to have a look at this on the laptop in a little bit more detail. Actually, you'll find that most of the planet is covered to some extent. And you can begin to see, if you look carefully, routes going across the major oceans where people have had their GPS on the plane and have followed and put that route and published it. So there's a huge amount of information there. I can't tell you how many pieces of information, because that has come from Google and we don't tell you about that sort of thing. But it's interesting in terms of the actual coverage. That's as it is today, after, I don't know, how long has GRSS and KML been in existence? A couple of years only. That's what we have at the moment. I think that's quite impressive. So there's this big change happening. There is the democratization of the tools to capture and manage and manipulate geographic information. Are the guys who control this listening? Are they seeing what's happening? As I said earlier on, there's a risk that the mapping agencies and the commercial providers don't understand what's happening. They could well be left behind. Well, from a government point of view, well, maybe people are beginning to listen. This was the Power of Information report that was done for the Cabinet Office by Ed Mayer and Tom Steinberg. If you haven't read this, it's well worth reading it and the response to it from the Cabinet Office, which, you know, for government is reasonable, I guess. You know, they've taken on a lot of the points and say, well, we're going to do something about it. Here are some points that come out of the government's response to this. The Power of Information was a report very well written by Ed and Tom that said, look, there's this big change happening. There's now communities having access to these tools, wanting to engage, wanting to be more active in government. What is government going to do about it? So Central Office for Information, that's what COI stands for, welcomes the opportunity to work with OOPSI in developing experimental partnerships between user-generated sites and major departments. Well, let's just keep it experimental at the moment, but we'll see where we go. Not too bad. Subject to resources being available, which always means, nah. keen to work with the trading funds and the Treasury to evaluate potential impact of a more enabling stance, I'm sure that means, for non-commercial reuse to encourage experimentation and innovation. Yeah, it kind of gives with one hand, takes with the other. Yeah, we think it's a good idea, but we're not going to fund it. And this is my favourite. Ordnance Survey will look seriously over the coming weeks at the recommendation to launch OpenSpace. For those of you who can't remember, OpenSpace was the idea of having an Ordnance Survey mapping API, Ajax-driven, much like Google and the others. Didn't go anywhere. Okay, now, last few slides. I think there's probably still some work for you guys to do. And I don't take this as a criticism in any way. This is just, well, from the outside, this is things I think you need to sort out. I wasn't around for the discussion yesterday about licensing, but licensing is a big issue for people who want to make use of information that any organization creates, or any software that people create. Go back to the Cathedral and the Bazaar. 80% of the book is about licensing arguments that went on in the Unix community to get to where we are today. So huge arguments about licensing is expected, I guess. You have to go through that. It's like growing pains. But eventually you come out and you agree on a licensing regime, or maybe a couple of licensing regimes that work and will give potential users of the data that you create the ability to use it in the way that they want to, whether that's to generate commercial revenue or not. The opportunities are there. So you need to focus on that. And then the other thing is to focus on finishing. How many people remember, maybe this is a kind of an ageist thing, the Rabbit telephone system? Yeah, remember Rabbit? Rabbit was this idea of basically taking the same technology you have with your home mobile, your home wireless telephone, but enabling lots of base stations around towns that you could use this phone, both at home and when you're out walking. So if you like, a kind of low-tech version of a cellular telephone network. And it survived about 2 years, I think. And the reason it didn't really work is because whenever you wanted to use your Rabbit phone, there was no base station. It was never there where you needed it. And there's a big part of when you're building geospatial databases that completeness is important. You have to have pretty much national coverage of where people are. You know, the same approach that the cellular mobile operators did when they were rolling out their networks. They chased the people. Say, well, we cover 99% of the population. And that's a good approach to take, I think. You know, you're not Ordnance Survey. You don't have to map a field in the middle of Scotland that's got a sheep in the corner. You know, it's not important. The sheep isn't interested. So you need to get it finished. The commercial sector, the commercial world is taking what you do very, very seriously and beginning to understand the power of harnessing the crowd to improve their databases. Probably most of you have seen what TomTom have been doing. They've developed this new application called TomTom Share. There are 10 million TomTom devices around the world. There are now 10 million surveyors. Because what TomTom Share allows you to do from your TomTom device in your car to update the database. So if you find something that's wrong, so for example, let's say this travel in Crawley is in the wrong place on the database, you go, I want to correct the location. Press that button. And it says, okay, well, what's wrong? Is you want to unblock a street? Do you want to change the traffic direction? Do you want to edit the street name? Do you want to add missing POI points of interest? Do you want to edit it? Do you want to report some other mistake? Okay, so we're going to edit the point of interest. We're going to move it, put it in the right place. And then when you dock your TomTom device back on its docking station when you get home, that information is uploaded to the central database, and then everyone has access to the data that you've changed. This is incredibly powerful. It's not capturing geometry of streets yet, but that's only a matter of time. And that's 10 million potential surveyors. Let me finish off with a slide from Google Earth. That's New Delhi, if you didn't recognize it. Everything you see on that slide, the data there, streets, points of interest, everything other than the imagery has been collected from non-commercial sources, not from the government, not from commercial data providers. It's been captured using exactly the same techniques that you guys have developed. And there's an increasing amount of information that we make use of in Google that comes from those sorts of sources. This is serious now. People in the commercial sector are making use of this information because it provides a good, reliable source of information that we can make use of. So what you're doing really is changing the way that the serious industry acts. And those people that don't take what you do seriously really run the risk of becoming the data generals, the digital equipment corporations of the world who ignored Apple, said, oh, these are just a bunch of guys in a garage with a wooden computer. Where are they going to go? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Got time for a couple of very quick questions, if anyone has any. Anybody?
Ed, yes, very good. Question regarding, right at the end there, regarding the reliability of data, bearing in mind that obviously as more and more gets built by the community, there's a lot of concern, I think, even within the OpenStreetMap community about, you know, will that be seen as reliable enough for the commercial use?
Yeah, I think there is a credibility gap, particularly when there is a choice. You know, when there is no choice, people will go, well, we'll take it and we'll look at it carefully. It's more of a sort of a competitive issue if there is a commercial data set to compare what you guys have. And I think it's going to take, you know, people actually analyzing the information, because there is no reason at all why what the OpenStreetMap community or any other community-generated data set, there's no reason why that should be any less accurate, any less up-to-date than commercial data. And if you think about it at a practical level, actually, it should be the other way around. You know, why wouldn't the commercial data be less accurate? Because of the very top-down approach that's taken to collecting that information. But you know, it's going to take a while for, you know, the traditional industry to get there. But you know, you think about it, TomTom aren't going to make use of OpenStreetMap data for a while. You know, you're going to have complete, consistent data in a format that is navigable, and that, you know, might not be an area that you actually want to get into. But it's going to take. It's going to take, you know, a test case to say, well, actually, for this particular example, this organization has taken the data. But, you know, it needs explaining. And as came up yesterday, you know, there's a huge number of people out there that don't understand what Wikipedia is. And those that do, there's a big section of those that believe it's all rubbish. And we all know that, you know, maybe less than half of 1% of Wikipedia entries are rubbish. 99.9% of them are excellent. But it's, you need to get that mindset for people to understand.
One more question.
My name is Petter Reynoldsen. I was with the project from the start, and you probably know about the Yahoo imaging being available for mapping in the OpenStreetMap project. When is the Google aerial photos going to be available on the same terms?
The data as well, please.
Well, if you'd like to make a contribution, it is quite expensive, the data, still. You know, Google spends hundreds of millions of dollars every year buying data. So, you know, until someone can create a nice, cheap, open source way of reliably flying aerial photography and launching satellites, that might be a bit of a stretch, but you never know. What was I saying yesterday? You should never believe someone tells you something's impossible. I think that's kind of verging on it, but you never know.
But this is Google we're talking.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, there are basic sort of, you know, commercial realities that we still have to get across. You know, we start incrementally. You can do the things that you can do. There's some things that it is just a commercial argument. You can't get around the fact that we have to license that data and the costs go along with that.
So. I'm aware that the American Radio Amateur Association are launching satellites on their own very cheaply.
Yeah. It is, and getting a sensor platform that is reliable and getting the high bandwidth that you need to send the imagery down, you know, unless you want to go back to the old days of dropping film canisters out of satellites, that is still quite difficult. But, you know, I think, you know, there's potential in UAVs in doing local aerial surveys and using that imagery. But I think it would be a long while before we can see an open source national imagery data set.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thanks.